In the book of Genesis, we have this remarkable statement in the book of beginnings. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." Wonder exactly just what life is. What is it? How do we define it? What is its origin? How is it sustained? Who is in control? All of these are questions that we're going to be dealing with today as we talk about this rather mysterious thing called life. And I would encourage you today to put your thinking cap on. And if you have any questions about or response to anything that I may say, as always, I welcome those questions. But today we want to talk about the mystery of life. And the first thing that we might want to do is to make an attempt at defining life itself. Actually, what I remember from my days in A&M, when I was brave enough to major in biomedical science, and those biology classes, is the difficulty that we had in defining just exactly what life is. We can talk about living beings and what they do, but in giving it a definition, I still grasp with giving it a definition. For example, we would say that a living object can take food from its environment, metabolize it for the production of energy. We can say it exhibits growth, or it can respond to external stimuli, can reproduce itself, and is capable of autonomous movement. And these might be, in some form or fashion, define and describe every living thing. And yet they simply describe the effect, but really do not give us a working definition of life. Remarkable statement that man became a living soul. One of the common questions that we deal with, of course, in society is the origin of life. Where did it come from? And of course, the evolutionists tell us that it came from what they call non-living matter, that somehow years ago, millions of years ago, that non-living matter, suddenly from that non-living goo came the first forms of life. We call that spontaneous generation, or they call it spontaneous generation. Robert Jastrow, a well-known evolutionist, explains the futility of the theory of spontaneous generation in this way. He says the experiment fires the imagination of the scientist. He sees the lightning, hears the thunder in a storm of Earth's primordial atmosphere. He smells the pungent mixture of ammonia, methane, and water. Nature's experiment is unfolding. The elements of life are accumulating in the water of the Earth. And soon the first living organisms will emerge. But they never do. At least not in the laboratory. The scientist experiment always stops short of its goal. And so he puts this non-living goo in the test tube. And in futility, he awaits for life to come, and it never happens. Thus, we would suggest that it is more reasonable to believe that an intelligent creator made all living things rather than to believe that somehow life accidentally sprang from non-living matter. And certainly the Bible affirms that, doesn't it? For example, the book of Genesis chapter 1, "And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, and to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, God says, I have given every green herb for food." And it was so. God was the very giver of every living thing. In the book of Acts, the 17th chapter and verse 25, on Mars Hill, concerning God, "Nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything." Why? Because he gives to all life, breath, and all things. He is the very creator and maker of life. Acts chapter 14 and verse 15. Again, Paul says, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them." I would suggest to you that the biblical model of creation and the biblical model of the origin of life is much more reasonable to believe than the concept of spontaneous generation. Let me give you an illustration. By the way, there's a book that just has absolutely fascinated me. The title of the book is I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It was written by Norman Geisler and written in a very simple fashion. And if you'd like to get one, you can order it at Amazon.com, because that's where I got mine. But in that book, he gives an illustration. He says there's a young boy named Johnny, and he gets up in the morning and he goes to the breakfast table, and Mom has already established to set the bowl in front of him and the cereal box. His favorite cereal happens to be the alphabets. But on this particular morning, she has arranged the letters in certain fashion with a message. Johnny, carry out the trash. Now, if Johnny decides that he doesn't want to be accountable to his mom, he can decide that this rather organized, simple but intelligent message came from mindless matter. But if he wishes to do what his mom says, he concludes that it came from an intelligent being. He receives a message and fulfills the task. The same Johnny leaves the house, and this day perhaps he has decided to go to the beach. And when he comes down to the beach, he finds in the sand a heart that is drawn in the sand and a message. Mary loves Johnny. Now, if he's taken a liking to Mary, he will probably conclude that this simple message came from an intelligent mind. Right? You begin to see the point? And thus we find the very complexity of life itself and all the things that are wonderful things in this world surely must come from an intelligent creator. But then the next question that we commonly deal with regard to life is, how is it sustained? Why don't we just sort of fly out of our body? Why don't we just fly apart? Why did this world not just explode and come apart and fall apart? How is it sustained? Life and the earth and the place that where we live. Well, the evolutionists would suggest that life is sustained by the same process by which they tell us that life evolved. That is, that we go from goo to the zoo by the process of natural selection. Natural selection is defined by Monroe Strickberger, and by the way, a textbook that was used several years ago right here at Texas State University. This is what he says. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, it follows that any being, if it varied however slightly in any manner profitable to itself, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected. A simple way to put it is survival of the fittest. And by this process of natural selection and mutation, they tell us that we can go from goo to the zoo. That is, that we can go from simple life forms, one-celled beings, to a much more complex being known as man. Now, there are a number of problems with natural selection, but one of the greatest problems of natural selection is your very body and its complexity. Let me give you an example. For example, we're made with approximately 600 muscles, and we could divide those two and classify those two into two basic types, voluntary and involuntary. Voluntary muscles are those that I have control over. That is, I decide to move my hand or decide to take a step. We call that voluntary. The involuntary muscles are like my heart. I don't even think about it. Every day I get up, the heart beats, and don't even have to think about it. Now, those are two very complex systems that work side by side and are absolutely necessary for me to exist. In fact, they are absolutely necessary for the human family to exist. Now, the very idea of complexity would suggest a problem with natural selection. For example, for the human family to exist, we'd have to have two complex systems evolving side by side so that we can go from goo to the zoo. Thus, I would suggest that the biblical model is also a better and more reasonable description not only of the origin of life, but of life wearing sustenance. And thus we find again on Mars Hill, he says, "For in Him, that is in God, we live and move and have our being," as also some of your own poets have said, "for we are also His offspring." You know, one of my favorites, I wasn't going to read it today, but I want to go to Psalm 104. And just real quickly look at the 104th Psalm, because this so wonderfully describes the providence of God in living things. I remember the times when Nancy and Ginger and Matt and I would go to the mountains in Colorado that I could not resist by at least using one of these, or using this psalm at least on one occasion for a simple devotional and a reminder of God's magnificence. He begins with, "Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, You are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty." And then he describes the workings of God in this world. That in verse 3, He lays the beams of His upper chambers in the waters. Who makes the clouds His chariots. Who walks on the wings of the wind and makes His angels spirits and His ministers a flame of fire. You who lay the foundation of the earth so that it should not be moved forever. You covered it with the deep and with the garment as the water stood above the mountains. At Your rebuke they fled. And the voice of Your thunder they hastened away. Verse 10. He sends the springs of the valleys and they flow among the hills. And they give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. By them the birds of heaven have their home. They sing among the branches. He waters the hill from His upper chambers. And the earth is satisfied with the fruit of Your works. If you ever spend any time outdoors at all, just standing in awe and admiration, just the quietness of a mountain stream, the nothing you can hear except the water coming down the mountain and flowing over the rocks and the tiny creatures that live there, and in the distance perhaps, if you're lucky, to see a moose or perhaps to see a herd of elk. All of those things just marvel me. And to stand and to watch the sunset, to see an eagle or to see a bird from its perch on the cliff, these things are wonderful. And by them, they are sustained by God. You see, what we learn about life is that God is in control here. And first of all, I would suggest to you that number one, God can lengthen life. For example, in the book of 2 Kings, the 20th chapter, and in verses 1 through 7, there was a man by the name of Hezekiah who was about to die, but God extended his life by 15 years. Now we could reason and say, well, was this a miracle or not? And I'll let you reason that. But nonetheless, God extended his life by 15 years. Or we might think of the book of Ephesians, the 6th chapter. Let's look at that one particularly. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 1 through 3, an interesting statement is made by Paul concerning the behavior of children. He says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth." Now, we recognize that this statement is a broad, general statement that sometimes has exceptions. Because we understand that sometimes good people die young. And then unfortunately, sometimes rather wicked people are allowed to live a ripe old age. And yet we also must not excuse ourselves and must recognize the very providence of God. Honor your father and mother, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Or in the book of Philippians, the 2nd chapter, and in verse 27, there was a fellow by the name of Epaphroditus. He was a wonderful servant of Paul. as well as the church at Philippi. And Paul says in Philippians 2 and verse 27, "For indeed he was sick almost unto death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have had sorrow upon sorrow." Apparently, because of the prayers of the saints, God had mercy on this servant and extended his life for a little longer. Thus, God can, if he so chooses, lengthen life. But I can tell you something else. God can also end life. For example, most of us are familiar with a fellow by the name of Enoch, mentioned in the book of Genesis, but also repeated in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and in verse 5. Now, here was a fellow who didn't die. Unlike everyone else, he didn't die. But in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 5, it says, "By faith Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God." So he didn't die. But in the case of David and Bathsheba, there was a baby boy that died. And the reason why is because of the wickedness of David and Bathsheba. So does that mean that every child that dies, that means the mom and dad are sinners? No. Does that mean every time a child dies that God has a direct hand in it? Not necessarily. But in this case, God had a hand in it. And in the case of Ananias and Sapphira, in the book of Acts, the 5th chapter, they lied to God and lied to the Holy Spirit about a certain contribution. And both of them, at the judgment of God, fell dead. And they're not the only example in Acts. Look in Acts, the 12th chapter. God is very specific in Acts, the 12th chapter, and beginning with verse 21. In Acts chapter 12... and beginning with verse 21, the text tells us about a certain wicked man, a ruler named Herod. And in Acts 12 and verse 21, it says that so on a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. And the people kept shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And then immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him, because he did not give glory to God. And he was eaten by worms and died. I don't know how to be more specific than that. And this is not the only examples. For example, back over in the Old Testament again, the book of Numbers, the 16th chapter. You remember that Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On gathered together and rebelled against Moses and Aaron. They were accusing Moses and Aaron of taking too much on themselves. They were not satisfied with the fact that Moses and Aaron were God's appointed leaders, and not satisfied with the responsibility that God had given to Korah and to these men. And because of their rebellion, Moses issues a challenge. Numbers 16:29. Moses said, "If these men die naturally, like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord." And it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah and with all their goods. And God had a hand in this. These men were punished with death. And there are a number of other examples. Uzzah, Nadab and Abihu. And there was a fig tree in the city of Jerusalem that Jesus cursed, and it withered and died. Yes, if God so chooses, he can end life. I think we need to use some caution here, though. First of all, we realize that we don't live today in the age of miracles. And because we don't live in the age of miracles, then I think we need to use words cautiously in saying, well, God caused that person to die. That would be, I think, something that would be, we need to be careful about. And I have theories about that, but I'm not going to share them with you. Because it would all be speculation. Could God still end a life? Yes, I think He could, if He so chose. But we need to be careful, I think, with regard to these things. But one of the things we do know about death is that it is the common fate of all men. The death rate, one per person. It comes to all men. And our responsibility is that while we live, as we noticed this morning, we have control over the future. That while we live, we need to do everything we can in our power to make sure that we are ready for the day in which we die. Then let's notice something else. Not only can God end life, but He can restore life. He certainly did during the days of Elijah. He brought to life, miraculously, a widow's son. And then also during the days of Elisha, there was a Shunammite son that Elisha brought back to life. And then there was a strange thing during 2 Kings, the 13th chapter. It seems that Israel was at war with Syria. And there were certain Moabite bands that came raiding. And because of that, the Israelites took a man that had died and they hastily buried him in the tomb of Elisha. And what happened? As soon as his body touched the bones of Elisha, he came back to life. God certainly in times past has worked such miracles in bringing dead people back to life again. And certainly we find several examples during the ministry of Jesus. For example, the 7th chapter of the Gospel of Luke and verses 11 through 18. Luke chapter 7 and verse 11 through 18, where Jesus raised and brought back to life a widow's son. And what is really neat is what is stated in verse 16. Concerning those that observed this miracle, they said that fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited His people. They marveled at the signs and wonders that Jesus was able to perform in that He could bring someone back to life. 9th chapter of Matthew, we have the ruler's daughter that Jesus brought back to life. And perhaps the most well-known is in John, the 11th chapter, in the example of Lazarus. You remember the discussion that Jesus had with Martha upon this occasion? Jesus said in verse 23, your brother will rise again. And in verse 24, Martha said to Him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives, believes in me, and shall never die. Do you believe this? And she said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And then to prove that very claim, even before his enemies, Jesus said these words in verse 43, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said, loose him and let him go. But Jesus certainly had the power then to bring someone who was dead back to life. And certainly the greatest example of the resurrection, of course, was the resurrection of Jesus himself. That 3 days after he was put into the tomb, he was brought back to life and appeared before witnesses. But what does all this mean to us? Now, first of all, it means to us that life is a very precious thing. Every day we live, give thanks to God for it. Give thanks to God for the health that we are given. and be grateful for another day that He has given us to serve Him. But it also reminds us of one final act of God in the end of time when all shall rise. Jesus very plainly stated in John chapter 5 and verses 28 and 29, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in the graves will hear His voice and come forth. They who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." The time is coming once every one of us will come from the grave and we will face a judge. Stand before that righteous judge, and our eternal destiny will be fixed. The final sentence will be given, and those who have done good will go into the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil into the resurrection of condemnation. God has given us today to prepare for that final day of reckoning. And I need to do, and you need to do, everything within our power to make sure that we're ready for that final day. Today, God has given you a little more time to prepare for the future. One more day to become a Christian if you've never obeyed the gospel. One more day to get your life right with Him if you are a Christian. To correct the things that you find in your life that are wrong. To acknowledge your transgression and sin before Him. To ask Him to forgive you. And to strive a little harder. To promise to Him that you'll try a little harder if you're given another day to serve Him more faithfully. If you're here today and subject to the invitation, if today it's your desire to become a Christian or to get your life right with God in any way, would you come now if you stand and sing? We'd be glad to.